This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff, and we are now at episode number 36. And before we get rolling, I just want to apologize to everybody for a couple week lag in bringing you a new episode. I got hit with some deadlines. Those of you in academia will hopefully understand. I submitted a manuscript to the Journal of Contemporary Family Therapy this last week, and I wrapped up a manuscript that I'm pretty excited about that I wrote with Ali Borden, who was a past guest on this show, and Golly Barak, who is an awesome therapist in LA, and Ben Carney from UCLA, titled Toward a New Paradigm in Substance Abuse Treatment. And hopefully you'll be hearing more about that in the future. But finish that up and got another submittal. And I should let you know, I have an article coming out this month in the Journal of Family Theory and Review. It's supposed to come out this month. They haven't let me know. I know it's supposed to come out in September, but the title of this article, which I wrote with my dissertation chair, Dr. Brian Distelberg of Loma Linda University, the title of this article is Developmental Pedagogy in Marriage and Family Therapy Education, Preparing Students to Work Across Epistemologies. And very proud of it. Hopefully you'll like it. I'm sure I'll probably share a link on the Radical Therapist social media, either the Facebook page or the Instagram or what have you. So keep an eye out for that. Pretty excited about that. That should be coming out this month any day now. And as soon as I find out about it, I'll let you know. But yeah, so that's kind of the reason for a couple week lag. And I just quite honestly, Charlottesville happened. I lost some energy, kind of took the wind out of me. And I was really thinking about how to maybe respond to that via this platform in a more meaningful way. And I haven't really figured that out yet, but it did have me going back. For those that don't know, I live in and grew up in Huntington Beach, California. And if you were to probably search some hate group maps or what have you, we've been for many years kind of notorious in some ways. Huntington Beach, I think, has a reputation. I was first introduced. I mean, these recent events have taken me back to probably nearly 40 years ago. I'm 51 years old. I was probably 14 years old when I first, if I were to be honest with everybody, when I first got introduced to my own whiteness. And that happened when a friend of mine that I knew just through surfing, growing up surfing with, he was a really good surfer. His name was Scott Miller. His nickname, Scottish. Those in the area might know that name. But I got into me and some friends were drinking beers. I was a little bit of a juvenile delinquent back in the day. But as probably 14 years old, we were all sitting around one day in the park drinking beers. And Scott had ridden up on his bike and was pretty excited about his new tattoo. And he rolled up his sleeves and showed us his new tattoo, which was a large black swastika on his arm. And that's when if I were to pinpoint a moment in my history, when I got introduced to my own whiteness, I think that's where it began. And Scottish, went on to co-found what is now probably one of the largest skinhead gangs in the country, PNI, Public Enemy Number One. And he was recently executed by his own gang, shot in the back of the head about 5, 6, 7 years ago now. And so there's a long history that's always kind of been in the shadows in where I grew up, and I've been around it, honestly. And I recently, probably 5, 6 years ago, I was serving on the City of Huntington Beach Human Relations Task Force. And right before I left the task force, our last thing we were dealing with was some neo-Nazi groups flyering or leaving flyers on people's lawns, promoting various things or various ways of thinking. And so it is nothing new. I guess I'm saying this is nothing new, but it is the volume, the visibility, all of it is ratcheting to a level I've never experienced, never seen. And it's quite alarming, quite disturbing, and had me going back into my own life and what have you. And so so I still want to somehow respond in some meaningful way. And if you have some ideas about how I might do that, people I might be able to talk to, people you'd be interested in hearing from, I would be more than happy to hear from you. Please just reach out to me at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com or any of the social media, and would be happy to hear from you. But anyway, let's get to our show, because we've got a good one. We're going to be talking with Justin Huft about what he calls insurrection therapy. And I'm very excited. I've heard of his work. I know some people that had caught his presentation at the last postmodern therapy gathering here in Los Angeles and spoke highly of it. And so we've had some conversations. We've been trying to put this together for a while. No fault of his, mostly mine. And then we finally made it happen. And I think you're going to be glad we did. So let me tell you a little bit about Justin. Justin Huft graduated with his MA in marriage and family therapy. He has worked with children, individuals, couples, and families in community clinics, elementary schools, and acute psychiatric residential programs. He currently practices in a treatment center in Malibu, California. He specializes in feminist experiential therapy and actively conducts research in feminist therapy, bibliotherapy, gender and sexuality, and postmodern therapeutic models. He teaches psychology at Saddleback College and psychology and sociology at Cal State Fullerton. He enjoys teaching, reading, writing, and rock climbing. And he's got a lot of ideas about how to do this work, and we're going to meet with him right now. Let's meet Justin. All right. Hi, Justin. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Yes, absolutely. I have to say, I was speaking actually with a couple of people. I was on, I don't remember where I was at, and I ran into you at the Postmodern Therapy Gathering here in Los Angeles, but I did not get to attend your talk, but I talked to multiple people who did and spoke very highly of it. And so I think this is a great opportunity for me to kind of spend some time with you and catch up on what I missed. So
good. Well, I'm glad that they liked it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was actually, it was really well spoken of. So thank you for making the time and talking to me. And I think I'll just kind of get right into it. In your work, I guess I don't remember the title of your talk at the Postmodern Therapy Gathering, but we're going to be talking a little bit about what you call insurrection therapy or insurrection in therapy. Mm-hmm. And so I guess I want to maybe start in your work around insurrection in therapy. I understand you start by critiquing the history of diagnosis, how the label of deviant has often been overused or incorrectly applied or abused for political reasons, for example. And I was wondering if you could just say more about that.
Sure. So I think that a lot of the work that all of us as mental health professionals do is grounded in some sort of diagnosis, right? We have some sort of label of deviancy or some label that we put on someone, and we have to be understanding how that may or may not be problematic and the historical problems that come up with that. And so what I always want to do when I give talks like at POMO is start by identifying some of the political abuses or just incorrect diagnostic measures and diagnostic labels we've used. So throughout history, we have had a really, really kind of tumultuous relationship in psychology and psychiatry with diagnosing. And this is not unique to marriage and family therapy or just psychiatry or just the United States. This is kind of rampant in all mental health professions. Some of the examples that I typically point to are drapetomania, which was the insanity that caused black slaves to want to be free. Hmm. And this is wanting to be free despite the early therapeutic interventions being torture. We know that during the 60s and 70s, blacks were labeled as schizophrenic due to their aggression, hostility, and identifying systemic institutionalized oppression. And then, you know, they would go and see their white psychiatrist, who would say, well, I'm doing fine. Doesn't look like there is such thing as oppression. Right. And, you know, then their entire reality is delegitimized. We see that race, in fact, was the single highest predictor for a diagnosis of schizophrenia throughout the 60s and 70s. We have diagnostic labels of homosexuality, egodystonic sexual orientation, transsexualism, gender identity disorder, you know, gender dysphoria, and the list goes on. Primarily what we see is that diagnosis, which is another way of saying deviant, stems from societal ideas and values about what is, quote, normal,
right,
and what is acceptable. And on kind of the, I don't know, the lowest level of maliciousness, we see therapists that have these internalized biases, and so they inappropriately diagnose. But we also see that there's a lot of political use of diagnosing. You know, sluggish schizophrenia, which was most often used in Russia, is a perfect example of that. This is diagnosed in a patient who showed no signs of schizophrenia or any psychotic disorder, but it was an assumption that these symptoms would appear later. So political revolutionaries were identified as having sluggish schizophrenia, put in mental hospitals, completely disenfranchised from the work they're doing, separated from their families and friends. And these are people that showed no symptoms, right? And that was, you know, it's easy to make up a diagnosis that includes no symptoms being present and then giving it to anybody you want. You know, and that happens in the United States too. The U.S. Attorney General Mitchell's wife, Martha Mitchell, we have the Martha Mitchell effect, which is misdiagnosing when accurate claims are dismissed as delusional. Mm. Martha Mitchell spoke out against Richard Nixon. Her claims later were accurate, but she was diagnosed with schizophrenia because some people don't have the privilege of speaking their truths and being legitimized, being heard.
Yeah, and long history, right? And so, but you're also critical of pedagogy of psychotherapy, and and draw on Worrell and Reamer's work around the seven fallacies of traditional therapy. And I guess I'm wondering if you could run us through those as well. This is a learning experience for me as well.
Sure. So Worrell and Reamer are really great researchers in feminist therapy, as well as kind of critiquing the pedagogy of psychotherapy, like you said. And they came up with these seven areas that they identified as being really problematic in mental health graduate programs. And these are things that reflect kind of this colonial agenda that we continue to teach. And it's androcentrism, heteronormativity, ethnocentrism. It's very deterministic. We pretend that nothing is nonlinear. We pretend that all the clients' lives are individualized and ahistorical. And maybe the one that gets, I think, in my opinion, the least amount of critique is Christocentric teaching. Mm,
right.
So those are the seven areas that in traditional therapy programs, Worrell and Reamer have identified as being really problematic, that those are kind of all the seven foundations that we lay our marriage and family therapy programs on top of, right? We're sort of taught that anything non-Protestant, non-male, non-heterosexual, non-white is considered diversity,
right?
Which also gives us the underlying message that, like, these white, straight Protestant men are the normal clients, and any other identities fall under this kind of additive diversity component, which is taught, you know, in a single diversity class where, you know, the class starts out with this statement chastising students for relying on stereotypes about identities, and then follows up to have 2 months of cultural fun facts about food and clothing and stereotypes of family structure and religiosity. And so, you know, we end up being in this.
I had that class too, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. We end up being in this really problematic space of don't use stereotypes, and here are all the stereotypes. And mostly our diversity training is on race. I don't know about you, but my program was largely race-based when we identify diversity. So we see that most of the clients are heterosexual, middle class, they're legal immigrants, or legal status, and the color of their skin changes. And that's our idea of diversity. But we still have this androcentric, heteronormative, you know, Christocentric, et cetera, kind of underlying basis.
Right. That's great. We'll get into that a little bit more because I have some questions about you, about what to do about that. But before we get there, you're also, your work is also informed by liberation psychology. And I wonder if you could describe for our listeners how you conceptualize liberation psychology and what are some of the tools, modes, or tactics in this model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that the first thing that listeners should do is listen to Dr. Brown on an earlier episode where he did a much better job talking about liberation psychology. But I think that the way that I have conceptualized it and integrated it into my practice focuses around consciousness raising, right? How does an individual engage in their socio-political environment? How do we get clients to identify what may or may not be working for them? How do we get them to identify the need to be critical? Part of liberation psychology involves working with how clients' individual identities exist in a sociocultural and historical context, right? We often forget historical. Mm-hmm. Psychology is typically very individualistic. So liberation psychology steps in and attempts to highlight how does the social orientation of a client, how do they find each of their kind of intersections of identities in different spaces, how does that exist, and how do they experience especially alienating environments, right? We oftentimes focus on what works well, but liberation psychology, I think, in my understanding, highlights how different identities experience oppression and alienation, and how then the client internalizes that. What sort of narratives do they build around that? It attempts to address the Eurocentric psychology, right? Kind of this Papa Freud and his very
yep.
androcentric beliefs and the therapist being the expert. Mm-hmm. We're hoping to limit therapists' internalized biases by allowing the client to be an expert and trying to decolonize some of our space in therapy. In critical realism, I think that we as liberation psychologists or therapists often try and highlight that therapists should not, in many cases, have preconceived ideas about what the problem is. Right, the problems that the clients are struggling with generate our ideas and conceptualizations about the problem, not the other way around. As opposed to a CBT type of approach, or at least a historical CBT type of approach, I would not want to enter into the room thinking that I understand kind of the totality to the the entirety of what the client is struggling with and why. The client's problems are going to inform me of that, and the client's history will inform me of that. It's not about helping others, liberation, right? Liberation work is not helping others. That's missionary work, which infers a very clear power hierarchy.
I like that differentiation. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that one thing that I have seen liberation psychology do, which has been really surprisingly absent in a lot of other therapy models, is it involves art and political process and dialogue and participatory research, and, you know, public conversation, theater of the oppressed, like a lot of the stuff that I think therapists miss, which is what does it look like for you to be a kind of holistically well, systemically well person, not just in therapy, but in the rest of your life? What does it look like to be engaged with your politics? What does it look like to be engaged with your community? What does it look like to be participating in things that are meaningful?
So are you pretty explicit with these kind of ideas or whereas I think some, there's a myth of neutrality oftentimes, I think, therapy but you tend to stand in a more explicit place when you're doing the work.
Yeah, so I definitely stand in a more explicit place. I think that there are times, because I work primarily with clients in crisis, where my explicit stance is softer or postponed. Mm-hmm. Because I think it is as a social constructionist, like, I can't have this monopoly on truth, right? I can't say, like, the client gets to make up their own truth, but I know what's best by stepping in and telling them, you know, how to be liberated.
This is a great truth.
Yes, this is the best truth.
Right.
So I think that I often have to check myself and figure out how can I have this theoretical framework, whether it's liberation psychology, feminist therapy, whatever it is, and have ideas about what tools I should be bringing to the table. How can I check myself and also remember that I'm not the expert in this process necessarily, right?
Yeah.
And it becomes difficult, I think, sometimes to do liberation work and think that you have good ideas, and also to kind of kick the stool out from under yourself and say, you know, the work that I'm doing is holding up the client. And at the same time, I'm finding myself in the expert position telling the client, well, why aren't you engaged in politics or doing art or, sure, you know, being involved?
Yeah. And you speak to the art of this, right? Or the, the intense nuance involved in this kind of work, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You mentioned feminist therapy. So I know your work is also very influenced by feminist therapy. Mm-hmm. We were having a conversation before we hit record, and you were kind of describing feminist experiential therapy. So I'm wondering if you could just share how feminist therapy, feminist thought is influencing your work and the way you do your work.
Yeah. So feminist therapy is, I think, really interesting to me because, like maybe experiential therapy, there are a lot of subcategories of feminist therapy, and some of them do not see things in a way that is congruent, right? You can't be this type and that type at the same time. I think that at its roots, feminist therapy is this really critical analysis of what marginalized identities are holding as their narratives, and how that is affected by kind of the dominant social discourse. Mm. So what does it look like to have an individual reauthor their identity? What does it look like to have an individual speak up their truths that are typically silenced, right? And these can be like externalized truths that have literally been silenced, or kind of the internal emotional expressions that they don't allow themselves to feel and they've been taught maybe are less legitimate. Hmm. Anger, I think, is a really good example of that. There are some groups that have the privilege of being angry and being legitimized in their anger, and there are groups that are more critiqued about the expression of anger as opposed to the underlying message about why they are angry. Black Lives Matter, I think, is a perfect example of that. I think feminist therapy really highlights the need to expand the definition of deviance. And what I mean by that is that, you know, therapists often use this standardized idea of deviance and what is normal, sort of what we talked about before. And so feminist therapy needs or attempts to depathologize the authentic expression of emotions, which in itself is an act of rebellion and insurrection, I think, in many ways, right? Mm-hmm. Behaviors are not necessarily the problem. They're a symptom of a larger unhealthy system. So when we have someone who is acting out, the feminist therapist may take that opportunity to explain that they are not deviant, right? They are a person who's struggling in an unhealthy, toxic situation, and these behaviors have allowed them to survive, have allowed them to get by, right? I think that one of the really important parts of feminist therapy is the egalitarian relationship, and this is not unique to feminist therapy, but I do think it is a direct response to certain models of therapy where the therapist is the gatekeeper of information. They are the expert.
Right.
So feminist therapy really values, I don't know if you could have any model of feminist therapy where the therapist doesn't directly try to deconstruct the therapeutic power hierarchy. The clients have to have that power in the therapy room. The clients have to take ownership of their space and have agency and accountability as well. And I think that if the therapist is the expert, then you really rob the client of their ability to have any sort of agency, meaningful agency in the therapeutic process or in the room. I think that another part, I'm trying to fit together different bullet points of, sure. of feminist therapy. Sure. I think that another really important thing that we sometimes miss is that mutual silence reinforces one another. And this is something that I am very explicit about. So this is something that I do find myself more often than not giving feedback about. When a client is struggling with something, I think that it is important that they identify it authentically and honestly. We want them to be congruent. And I think that anytime a client is in any sort of system and they choose to stay silent about something, that puts them in a really possibly problematic space where that's reinforcing silence of other people. It's reinforcing their own silence and ongoing silence. It's reinforcing this idea that their feelings are not valid, or at least not valid enough to say out loud. You know, it's reinforcing this idea that they can be disempowered by themselves quite easily. So I think that this idea of giving space and sometimes demanding space for silenced emotions, silenced identities is really important.
Yeah, that's an interesting approach. Yeah, I'm wondering how you work to make that space so that people can step out of silence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I find that really interesting.
Yeah, and maybe you can jump in because I think that one of the things that I really appreciate in learning about other therapeutic models and hearing from other, you know, kind of leaders and experts in kind of their own domains is figuring out how do they all empower their clients? Because that looks very different. Every therapist, I think, is going to say they empower their clients, but that's going to look radically different.
I'm sure, yeah, right. And I guess I'm just sitting here thinking how we even think about silence, right? And, mm-hmm. And it's just an interesting take. I hadn't heard that before, so I guess maybe I need a little time to think about that, like how explicit you are about taking on silence. And mm-hmm. and I don't know if I would be as maybe that explicit. So you have me thinking, I guess that's what I'm thinking. Yeah. which is always good.
Good.
Yeah,
good.
Right.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, well, I was just going to say one other thing that popped up is that I think that it's important that we judge our clients not on their ability to cope necessarily or conform or adapt, but to bring out the healthiest parts of themselves. Mm. And I think sometimes therapists will accidentally reinforce silence because they are attempting to help the client cope and conform and adapt. Mm. I think that's a really tricky situation because how can I, as a therapist, do good work with someone and then send them back to kind of this oppressive hegemony, this really toxic, problematic yeah. space. Yeah. And, you know, yes, they are coping and adapting and they're conforming to that space, but I don't know if that's bringing out the healthiest parts of themselves. So I think maybe I am a little bit more explicit in the need to not stay silent about certain things, because I think it's important that clients, are judged on their ability to bring out the best parts of themselves and be congruent and vulnerable and not necessarily just try and keep the peace.
Yeah, and I guess I was thinking in regards to silence, we were having this conversation in one of our supervisions this week about our responsibility to talk about things like race and. Mm-hmm. And, with Charlottesville going on now and these kinds of things, it's that in some ways, because we are in that power seat as therapists, that the responsibility falls on us to bring up things like mm-hmm. race, class, genders, sexualities, these kinds of things, and mm-hmm. what's at risk, right? And mm-hmm. making maybe in an attempt to make some space for these conversations to be spoken about. But sometimes, you know, being a white therapist, white male cis mm-hmm. therapist, you know, people aren't going to feel really safe with me right away.
Yeah.
And so So I got to, I think in some ways I feel like I need to honor that silence,
mm-hmm.
But also working towards kind of an understanding, hopefully that I do have I do understand what they might be going back into when they leave my office. Right.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. And I'm something about that. I'm picturing kind of this Fritz Perls response. Like, can you tell me right now that you're not comfortable with me? And can you identify that, you know, honestly and authentically, instead of maybe just us identifying it without it being said? I don't know, maybe that is more problematic, that, you know, a white cis male therapist is demanding that a client speak a truth that they're not ready to speak.
Yeah,
I'm not sure. That's tricky.
This is one of those things you and I, we go have a cup of coffee and we just we hash over. But I just think it's really interesting. So moving on, I was thinking about the word insurrection and your work in encouraging insurrection. And I'm wondering if you can say more about this and how you do that, maybe how you came to that kind of perspective.
Yeah. So I think that insurrection is a very provocative word. And I think that that's what therapy often looks like, though, right? Like, we are provoking a lot of things that are maybe not comfortable for the client. And we are asking the client in many cases to be brave enough to go into a space that maybe would push against certain boundaries that they would try and avoid. But ultimately, like, what we often ask the client to do is to encourage the client to rebel against a society that encourages self-hatred in a lot of ways, right? We encourage the client to rebel against a system that pathologizes cultures and identities. We encourage the client to rebel against a system that oppresses individuals. I think that is insurrection, right?
Mm-hmm.
I had a client once, I had a student at one of my talks once say that insurrection is too violent of a word. And I think that that's a really interesting idea. I think that insurrection can look violent on the outside, but what we need to be critical of is what we are considering violent and what we delegitimize when we critique how someone speaks their truths as opposed to listening to what they say.
Sure.
Yeah. Right?
Right.
You know, again, I don't think that it's appropriate to judge this client's like progress based on their ability to kind of go back into a problematic system. So often what their work is this act of insurrection, this rebelling against maybe what their family thinks they should be or what previous therapists think they should be, right? We want people to align their thoughts and behaviors with what they think is congruent, what they think is true, as opposed to how I think I view a lot of traditional psychotherapy, which is the therapists want the clients to align their thoughts and behaviors with what the therapists want or what society wants. You know, I know that in the article you talked about in a previous episode, how psychotherapy lost its magic.
Right.
You know, a mother was told to accept the death of her daughter. I mean, how problematic is that when a therapist tells a mother to accept something that she's not ready for or doesn't want, right?
Right.
I think that is another way to control and to colonize the expression of emotions, largely because we're uncomfortable with authenticity. We're uncomfortable with other people being uncomfortable. So I think insurrection looks like you are going to find a truth and you are going to speak it unapologetically.
Okay. Also, going back to the arts, you mentioned the arts, and this is something near and dear to me as well, but I get the sense that your work encourages participation in the arts. And
yes.
And I agree. I think there's a lot of intersections available to us there in that, in dance, and like you said, theater and just visual arts, what have you. But I was wondering if you could just say more how you work with that and how you encourage that kind of work.
Yeah. Yeah. So I actually am very, very fond of poetry. And I think that poetry, therapy, the reading and writing and creation and deconstruction of poetry is very parallel to a lot of narrative therapy work,
sure,
which I think supplements and is supplemented by feminist therapy really well. So most of my encouragement in art tend to be poetry therapy, a lot of group poetry therapy and individual poetry therapy. And I think that a lot of the goals that I have as a feminist therapist, are accomplished through poetry. I will often encourage clients to participate in painting and expressive writing and drawing, but I think that I gravitate towards poetry because it has this ability to encourage consciousness raising. It has this ability to encourage clients to move towards self-determined change when they do work and when they identify kind of their own processes in therapy, right? Because they're writing it out. They're literally identifying it. I think it encourages clients to normalize and validate and understand the importance of the entirety of the continuum of emotions. I think it encourages clients to have a sense of empowerment and agency in their own therapy because they now have complete control over the construction of a language and how they want to use language and it, language that's unique to only their experiences, which also helps, I think, the clients to establish an identity, which is really important, right? And their identity is no longer commodified, right? And it's not... For example, for a lot of the female clients I work with, it's not just I am a wife or I am a partner. It's I am, and then they can fill in something that it is not necessarily just the commodification that someone else has control over, right? It's not just supplementing someone else's identity.
Yeah, that's great. You also, and you talk about client empowerment and encouraging kind of a vulnerability in your work, and I understand this could be tricky, when, I imagine, when working with or oppressed or marginalized people. And I'm wondering, how do you work with vulnerability?
So yeah, it's tough. I think that we've been taught based on our own intersections of identities, a lot of different messages about how we should and should not feel. And so there's a lot of work around unpacking and challenging these messages or these narratives, right? I think that you can't get someone to be really sustainably vulnerable if they don't have an understanding about their own narratives and beliefs about vulnerability and about expression of authentic emotions. I think that vulnerability requires a lot of trust in others and trust in yourself and trust in the therapeutic process and a willingness to move away from social narratives that discourage vulnerability and authenticity. So I think that a lot of my work is starts in consciousness raising.
Right. Okay.
Which both liberation and feminist therapy identify. I think that a lot of the work is just let's unpack kind of as much as we can comfortably, and then figure out what is inside it and how this fits together. And we will try and be experiential in the sense that we'll identify how is our body feeling in this case, right? When you are talking about your parents and you're tapping your foot, or you are, you know, having this furrowed brow, and when you are experiencing tightness in your chest, like what is that about? So there is kind of this exploration into the physiological that goes along with the psychological and sociological, and I think that that's really important to for their emotional insight and their understanding of their emotional experience. But I think most of vulnerability is starting in just consciousness raising. What is your insight about where you got these messages, why you got these messages, which messages and narratives did you choose not to believe, right? Because very rarely do people have all of the messages for all of their identities line up and are congruent and all say the same thing, right?
Right.
I think that most of the vulnerability work, encouraging vulnerability is a trust in themselves and then a systematic unpacking.
Yeah, and you raise something, and I guess it goes back to the experiential question. I'm just in my own mind, I'm enjoying this conversation, Justin. I just want to say that because it's got me thinking about a lot of different things. And my experience is a lot of what would kind of fall under the postmodern therapy umbrella has tended to ignore the physicality and therapy and kind of maybe that kind of thing. And it seems that you do work with it. And I'm wondering, like, do you find it valuable? How did you come to, you know, these kind of, I guess I was just kind of wondering, I don't get to have these kinds of conversations a lot. So I'm wondering how you work with it or how you, do you, is it really a large part of your practice?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that, and maybe there's something really significant that this sort of conversation is very rare for both of us. I think that the physicality was the first thing that I think I developed an awareness of as a student, even. I think that for some reason we as students and therapists and doctors and, you know, all of us in mental health, we see all of this physical stuff and we just chalk it up to something insignificant. You know, when the client is tapping their foot or clenching their fists or laughing or smiling as they're talking about, you know, the death of a loved one, we see that incongruency or we see any of these things and we just kind of gloss over it. And we say, well, what is my manualized treatment manual say? Well, you know, very rarely is it identifying kind of the improv of therapy, right? Very rarely.
I like that word. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very rarely identifying the here and now of a client, because how do you, you know, put into a manualized treatment how to meet someone at the here and now? That's hard. It's hard to write a whole book about something that is going to be improvised. So that was the first thing that I saw as a student in, you know, in the training center in my grad school. The first things I was noticing with clients, you know, before the Bowenian system structure, before the triangles and any of that, was like, my client looks uncomfortable, or my client is not congruent. They are happy when they probably should be sad, or they are sad when they probably should be anxious, or, you know, kind of all of these different nuanced physicality. Yeah, I'm not sure why we miss that, because it seems so important.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think there's like some people in LA that are interested in kind of talking about the body and the physiological and the physicality, and I really like your word, the improv of therapy. That was but in my own training, even in, you know, let alone just the basic kind of grad school training, but also and even in postmodern kind of things, just something, it's just something that at least in the circles I was running in just wasn't really talked about. So I find it interesting to talk about it. So
yeah,
okay. So kind of going on, you call for a critical pedagogy in therapy, and I'm wondering if you could say more about what this might look like, or is this kind of a critical education that goes on in therapy, or what are some of the principles of this kind of idea?
So critical pedagogy, I think, really interests me because there's this parallel process between teaching and learning and being a therapist and being the student, and kind of all of those can exist on many different levels, and the content might change, but the process looks almost identical. So the critical pedagogy in therapy, because we are teaching as therapists, right? We may teach, you know, the specifics about what their dreams are if we are a Jungian therapist, or we are, you know, teaching what tools to be using or how to reauthor their narratives, you know. We are teaching at the end of the day in many ways, and we are learning at the same time. But I think that there's this attempt to help the client question and challenge their beliefs and the practices that dominate them, right? It's an attempt to create this critical consciousness. And this critical pedagogy foundation directly parallels the liberation psychology approach or the feminist therapy approach in many ways, right? We have this social constructionism aspect. We value these multiple perspectives. There is this deconstruction of the taken for granted realities and practices. I mean, these are all things that you've talked about. These are all things that, you know, a lot of the people at POMO gatherings talk about. These are things that the feminist therapists are talking about, right? We can't just have a client say, well, this is what I should do, without saying, whoa, where did you get that should from? Right? So we have to explore and identify the things that maybe they take for granted. In this critical pedagogical approach, we also are asking the client to reauthor their history and their narrative. So they don't have to identify as marginalized and oppressed. They can identify as someone who has experienced oppression, even ongoing oppression, ongoing marginalization, but they can move their margins to the center, right? And we can decenter what they consider normal or typical. There's a focus on their strengths in that case, right? Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of the praxis of critical pedagogy involves this ongoing cycle between the theory, right? Kind of what the therapist might think or the client might think, hopefully it's together, and then the application of it, and then the evaluation of it, and the reflection, and then back to the theory, right? Mm-hmm. So that's therapy. So, you know, we have kind of the same process and we call it different words. So, you know, right now we're calling it critical pedagogy. When we're at the POMO conference, we'll call it something different. When we're at a different place, we'll call it liberation psychology. I think that it's very similar process though, right? We're collaborating, trying to put it into praxis, reflecting on it. And then as a team, we are rebuilding truth, right? We're democratizing truth. And clients are not just taught coping skills just so that they can, you know, kind of have this banking system of therapeutic education, right? I can't just say, you know, use this mindfulness app when you're depressed and, yeah, you know, do that twice a day and write in your journal for 5 minutes and then recall these skills at a totally arbitrary time for like largely no reason, right? That, I mean, that's the banking system of education. What we want is for the clients to have like an understanding, this consciousness raising, this very deliberate integration of what we are talking about in the therapy room into the rest of their lives. And that is critical pedagogy. Right, like that's how that looks.
Yeah, that's great. Now, you also teach at a couple local colleges, universities, and I guess I'm wondering, just to kind of get your take, what do you think? And I do as well, but I was wondering what you think these programs should be teaching now. I mean, what do you see as maybe additive to what's going on currently?
I think that question almost mirrors the problem, right? If we say additive, that's the problem that we have right now. Okay. Because we don't have diversity education that is, and I focus a lot on diversity education, we don't have diversity education that's integrated into the curriculum in a really meaningful, important way. Right. What we have is diversity education that is additive, like, you know, like we talked about before, and it's just this, you know, 2-month class about what food they eat and maybe where do they go to synagogue or temple or church and also what you might see them wearing, and that's it. You know, maybe you're lucky if you learn a couple words in their language and that's about it. And it's all additive, right? What we should be doing is starting academic programs with a series of cultural courses to prime students. We should be infusing every class with diversity curriculum. We should be directly labeling and teaching like heteronormative, misogynistic, Christocentric flaws in the model so that when students go to someone like Bowen or Mnuchin or Carl Whitaker, right, they're able to hold them up but also see how hugely problematic these people are and their models are, right? We should be integrating diversity into treatment conceptualizations, right? Even if you have this white Protestant middle-class male, you're identifying diversity, right? And I think that that's one of the things that I have seen maybe like the biggest blind spot in is that therapists that I have worked with, students that I have worked with or been, you know, in the same cohort with, when we have someone who's a, you know, if we have a white client, they're like, oh, I don't have to worry about diversity. Or if we have a Christian client, I don't have to worry about diversity. Yeah. Right.
Well, I'm happy to say then one of the papers I wrote was working with Christians. So
great. Good. Yeah. So that's perfect. Right. And yeah. I think
people were surprised I was picking that as a topic, but yeah, that's
well, of course, because you know, Christian is normal and everything else is requires literature to identify diversity. So I think that we also need to encourage self-reflection into how your own identity gains from and contributes to systems of oppression. And I really believe that we as therapists, as perhaps therapists that are also involved in different social justice work, like we have to be identifying our own privilege and contributions to oppression if we want any chance at understanding and building a safe space in our therapeutic room with clients who experience oppression. It's going to be really tough for me to sit across from a client and say, I hear you and I understand you and I'm validating you and all of your feelings are legitimate if I really don't understand and I really don't know. And when they look at me and say, you know, you are in many ways the face of what has been oppressed me. You are in many ways the reason why I am here. It's going to be hard for me to, and it's going to be hard for them to do good work if I am not understanding that.
I totally agree. And I think like the most important thing I can do, like I said, as a white male, cis, hetero, on and on, is to educate myself, less educating anybody else, but educating myself is my most important task.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that I'm a little bit more radical as a teacher than I am as a therapist in some ways.
Sure,
like I
sure.
very strongly think that we should have an anti-colonial education. We should really value indigenous knowledge, which is part of this critical pedagogy. I'm very critical of this banking system of education. I think that we need to very directly and explicitly challenge existing hegemonies in education, in kind of academia in general. I think that most of my research has focused on diversity and things like experiential therapy because those were the models that I gravitated to as a student, feminist therapy and experiential therapy. But it seems like the more I look at models outside of that and the pedagogy of therapy in general, the more it is, I think, unsurprisingly disappointed, maybe is the best way to put it, at how much we are missing. And I think I'm often shocked and horrified at how really, really good therapists who identify a lot of the things that I think are important really fail as a teacher teaching those same things. I would like to think that that's not unique to psychology, that's, you know, just something inherent about teaching or something. I don't know, but we have to be doing a better job,
sure.
You know, increasing awareness and owning privilege and moving towards an understanding of historical context and moving towards action and accountability. Yeah.
That's great. And on that note, I will say, before I let you go, two things, I guess I have two questions for you. How can people contact you after hearing this and wanting to kind of reach out to you? And do you have any other presentations coming up? Or I think you have a publication coming out, right?
Yeah, well, I hope so. yeah, that's the goal. So people can contact me at my email address at one of the colleges I work at. It's jhuft, H-U-F like Frank, T like Tom, at saddleback.edu. I do have a publication in review for the Journal of Feminist Family Therapy, and then a publication that should be in review soon in Epstein's new narrative therapy.
Yeah,
which is a really cool like anti-journal. I highly encourage people to look into it. It's really great.
Absolutely. Maybe I'll link it in the show notes for this episode so people can access it. But Justin, this has been a long time coming. We finally made it happen. I'm really glad we did. This has got me thinking about a lot of stuff. And like I said, and it's been a great conversation. And just thank you for making the time, being patient, and making this happen.
Thank you for having me, Chris. I really appreciate it.
It's been great.
Okay. Have a good one.
Well, that's our show, and as always, thanks for listening, and please, I love interfacing with you all via social media or email. Send me emails. I love reading them. So please, you can find us on the web at theradicaltherapist.com, on Instagram at theradicaltherapist, Twitter at theradtherapist, on Facebook at theradicaltherapist. And I think that's pretty much all of it, I think. But please reach out to me if you'd like stickers, let me know. I have some shirts left if you'd like a Radical Therapist shirt. Just reach out to me. You can see what they look like on the Instagram page. So just go on that and go check it out. And yeah, so please, love to hear from you and love to just kind of, you know, be in community with you. So find us on social media. So, well, anyway, that's our show. This has been The Radical Therapist, and my name's Chris Hoff.